What's up, guys? This is the judge, Daniel Green. You can find me on Twitter at DanielAGreen1. I am very proud to have a special edition of DG Courtroom for you guys for Thursday. There's only a three game slate, so I'm not going to do a normal hour long podcast break, you know, giving you a recap of Wednesday's games and also giving you my top plays for Thursday. Instead, what I'm going to do is even better, I think. I'm going to basically post my conversation that I just had this afternoon with special guest Andy Larson, who's a Utah Jazz beat writer and also an affiliate of the Utah Jazz, radio host, you know, et cetera, et cetera. A Utah Jazz guru. He killed this interview. I thought he did a phenomenal job. To give you a quick rundown of what we talked about, I mean, we basically talked about beat writers' kind of thoughts on DFS, because, you know, I thought all along beat writers, you know, hate DFS players because, you know, we basically nag them all day. You know, is Favors going to play? What's wrong with Favors? And basically saying guys that are having horrible nights, even though in real life they're having great nights. We also talk about Derek Favors, what's been going on with him this year. We talk about one of the judges' favorite topics, the topic of pace, right? Utah plays at such a slow pace. So what's the reason for that? Andy tells us why they play at such a slow pace. We talk about the enigma of Dante Exum. What's going on with him this year? He certainly has not performed and lived up to expectations. We also go into a little bit about Trey Lyles, because I know a lot of you on Twitter asked me about if I could ask Andy about Trey Lyles. We talk about how good Rudy Gobert is. We also cover, can Gordon Hayward be the best team on an NBA title team? Can he even be the second best player? We talk about that as well as talking about the rest of the season outlook for the Utah Jazz in terms of DFS and also real life basketball. And Andy gives us a couple sleeper players that he thinks can have you know, finish the regular season strong in both real life and also DFS. So give it a listen. I really do think you guys will like it. I mean, Andy sheds some light on the topics that, quite honestly, we wouldn't get anywhere else. He lets us talk. He talks to us a little bit about the NBA shoot-arounds each morning and kind of how he works, how coaches work with the press and let the beat writers know about injury news. So it's some pretty cool stuff. He's taking us a behind the scenes. It's just a really cool info. I thought it was a really good interview. He killed it. I was okay. But I hope you guys enjoy it. And if you guys are kind enough, and if you guys, you know, do enough retweets, if you download the app Draft, if you retweet out the show, both the podcast with Andy, and then also tomorrow, I think of what I'm going to do an hour before lineup lock, I will post a 5 to 10 minute clip of my favorite plays of the day. So hopefully I will give you guys that as well, as long as you are kind to the judge. But for the most part, that's it for me right now. Currently, it's only 10:56 p.m. Eastern, so the judge is going to be able to get some sleep tonight. Currently, the Clippers and Houston are just tipped off about 10 minutes ago. So I can't even give you dream killers and dream lovers, although I will say John Luer put up like 40 Fando points, go figure. But don't worry, I'll be back tomorrow with a whole new show recapping Thursday night's game and getting you prepared for a massive Friday night DFS slate. But until then, enjoy the podcast with Andy Larson. Also, give him a tweet, you know, follow him on Twitter, obviously. Follow his podcast that he has. And send him a tweet and let him know that you enjoyed the podcast with him, because, again, I do think it is worth your time. So for me and the bailiff, enjoy the show. And here we go.
Court is now in session.
Damn.
This episode of DG's Courtroom is sponsored by Draft, a daily fantasy app where your chances of winning are almost three times better than on FanDuel or DraftKings. On Draft, it's draft day every day. You can do a simple snake draft for one day whenever you want. Drafts take just minutes to complete. Download Draft now. Be sure to enter the promo code DFBPOD when you download to get a 100% deposit bonus. And with that, we are off. Welcome to a special edition of DG Courtroom. I am very honored to have Andy Larson, a Utah Jazz beat writer, an ESPN True Hoop affiliate of the Utah Jazz, radio host of ESPN 700 on 7 to 9. Is that Eastern time Thursday, Andy? What time is that?
No, that's Mountain Time here in Salt Lake City. So okay,
Mountain Time. So I guess that'd be 9 to 11 Eastern?
That's correct.
Okay. And so as you guys have known, listening to this, I've been plugging Andy coming on the last week or so. You guys have given me a lot of good questions to ask. And Andy, welcome to the show. I'm glad to have you. Feel free to plug whatever you want.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, I'm Utah Jazz beat writer for KSL.com. We're the NBC affiliate here in Salt Lake City. And then, yeah, like you said, the radio show we do for our local ESPN 700 affiliate, or ESPN affiliate, ESPN 700, here with Zach Harper, maybe more famously known as at Talk Hoops on Twitter. So we have a good time, do a Almighty Baller podcast called the Salt City Hoops Show. So check that out if you guys want. And yeah, I guess my writing on KSL.com.
Fantastic. And so I was talking to Andy a little bit offline. And so this is mostly a daily fantasy, a DFS show, but also more general basketball as well. So we'll talk DFS obviously with Andy, but we'll also talk about just Utah Jazz in general in terms of a real life NBA perspective. And there's lots to get to, because as I was telling Andy and all the listeners know, what's one team that has flummoxed us all year, probably the last 2-3 years maybe. And that's Utah. And out of all the teams that I've watched play, and I was telling Andy this as well, Utah might be the team I've had a chance to watch the least of. And that makes sense from a DFS perspective, because of the pace, we don't normally roster a lot of the Utah guys. And that's why getting Andy's perspective on a lot of just the overall Utah team, the system, the pace, the rotation, the minutes, I think this will be just really informative for all the listeners. So Andy, can't thank you enough for joining. And let's hop into it, man.
Cool.
All right. First, we got to talk about last night's game. I don't know how many of you guys watched. Utah played Oklahoma City. And while everyone was probably watching Golden State, Washington, and seeing the horrible Durant injury and some other games, this might have been the best game of the night, Andy.
Yeah, it was an incredible game. And honestly, both teams played super well. I mean, the crazy thing was just how well the Oklahoma City Thunder shot the ball from downtown last night. I mean, they're the worst shooting team in the league. And I know they, you know, acquired Doug McDermott and didn't play Victor Oladipo, put Alex Abrines in the starting lineup last night, but still scoring 12 threes in a row to begin the game, you know, making 12 of 12 literally hasn't happened before. And again, from the league's worst shooting team, it was like this crazy, you know, crazy, unlikely, astronomically improbable thing that happened. And yet it still happened to be a close game. You know, the Thunder only led by 8 at half. And then the Jazz had a 4-point lead going into the last minute. And then Russell Westbrook just took over, you know, the 43 points, triple double,
yep.
and just Russell Westbrook at his very best.
Yeah, I mean, I think at one point, I think it was you tweeted out like the odds of actually Oklahoma City. I think they shoot, 32% from 3-point range on the year. I mean, they're even worse than the Bulls. And I watch every Bulls game because I'm a huge D Wade fan. I mean, they are, like you said, dead last. And I think the odds of them making 13 for 13 or starting the game that way were it was astronomically impossible.
Yeah, it's 800-1 or 800,000-1 odds, right? So like this never happens. And it's funny, like, Kevin Pelton actually did the calculations with taking into account the shooting percentage of the guys who took the shots. So, you know, and I think they had good shooters taking those shots more than they usually do. You know, like Doug McDermott's a good shooter. Abrines is a good shooter. But, you know, still Westbrook's a 32% shooter and made, what was it, 3 or 4 or 4 in that first half. So it's just one of those crazy things that happens. And again, like for the Jazz to be in that game shows, I think, how well the Jazz played. It's funny, like going into the game, the Jazz talked about how much they wanted to allow, they just wanted to pack the paint against the Thunder and make them take those outside shots. And then they still did that. And even in the second half, at the halftime interview, they talked to the assistant coach and he said, you know, we're still going to stick with this game plan, even after they had hit 12 threes in a row. So, you know, it's one of those nights from a Jazz perspective that there's just not much more you could have done.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, there were so many different things of that game that I found interesting. I mean, one of them I found pretty fascinating was just to see how overmatched Dante Exum appeared to be. I mean, I think in his first time in the game, he got like 50 seconds and got two, and Westbrook had two fouls on him. Did that stand out to you as well? Just watching Dante kind of get overmatched a little bit.
That's happened this season for sure. With really elite athletic point guards, you know, the Jazz played the Wizards on Sunday and facing John Wall, kind of the same thing happened where it was just really clear Dante Exum didn't have any chance against guarding John Wall. And, you know, the same thing happened with Westbrook. I think that's happening with him and elite point guards this year. And Quinn Snyder is really trying to play George Hill more against those guys. It's not something that's been new this year. I think he's lost a step laterally since the ACL injury, and you know that may still come back, but he's definitely not as good defensively as he was his rookie season, and I think that's really impacting the minutes that he's playing on the floor.
Yeah, and we'll get to a more specific Dante Exum question later. Because I mean, Like I said, I haven't watched a ton of Utah, so I was actually excited when I saw Dante come in the game because as I said, we'll talk about this in a few minutes, but I've always wondered why is he only getting 18 minutes, especially when George Hill's been out so much this year. And I was like, wow. I mean, he was basically in, and then I went to Minnesota, and he was out of the game. I was like, oh my god. So it was pretty interesting. But I mean, that was an awesome game. And then Westbrook down the stretch, what he did was just—I'm not sure how many other guys can do that. So,
yeah, none. I think that's fair to say.
Yeah. All right. So let's get a more specific DFS question because I envision all the beat writers like you hate daily fantasy sports, you hate FanDuel DraftKings, and you hate more specifically people like me who are doing podcasts on DFS and ranting and raving on Twitter about saying what a horrible game someone had from a DFS perspective, even though in real life that player might have done well. Just give me from a beat writer's perspective, this fascinates me. Give me your overall kind of thoughts regarding the DFS realm and how this has kind of taken over. Kind of the at parts of the NBA, it seems like in the past few years.
Yeah. So if you guys are whoever it is says someone has a bad game, even though they want, I just don't care. That's totally fine. I think what beat writers do get annoyed with is, myself included, is when DFSers come at us, asking us questions on Twitter, asking something like, is Derek Favors going to play tonight if he's a day-to-day kind of injury, or is questionable or probable or doubtful, and we just don't have any idea unless they've already told us. And of course, we're not going to keep that information secret. If we have any nugget of information on whether or not a guy is going to play, we're going to tell you guys. I mean, that's our job, is to disseminate that information. Right. So I think that's maybe where we get actually annoyed with DFSers, is just the constant, is X player going to play, especially on a team like the Jazz that have had so many day-to-day kind of injuries where you don't know if a guy is going to play, and it's impactful players like George Hill or Gordon Hayward or Derek Favors. That's where we get annoyed, I guess. Other than that though, we don't care. I think we're happy to have the interest because, more eyeballs helps us keep our jobs.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think this year I've only done that one time regarding asking a beat writer. And I think it was against, so Rick Carlisle drives me insane with his rotations and minutes, and from a DFS perspective can be, even though again, real life, I think he's a phenomenal coach, but DFS, and this is where it gets tricky, separating the real world from DFS, but DFS, he drives me insane. So I think I tweeted out asked a beat writer one time a question about, I can't remember who it was about. It might've been about, Dirk's minutes or someone, and he gave me, I could kind of tell he was pissed off just by his answer. So after that, I was like, I'm not going to do that again, because that I know that must annoy you guys.
So let me tell you kind of the way to do it if you are going to do it.
Oh, fantastic. Yes.
So if you are going to do it, we get two media availabilities on game day, right? We get the shoot around. If there's a back-to-back, most teams cancel that shoot around. But if it's not a back-to-back situation, there's a shoot around in the morning, usually at 10 to 11 local time. So if we don't know somebody's status coming into a day, we will find out an official injury report from the team or from the coach or whoever is speaking that day. We can ask a player about it, if they've practiced or not. Those sort of things all happen in the shoot around at, like I said, 10 to 11 a.m. local time. And then if we find something out, we'll tweet it out as soon as we know, because there's that kind of race, there's that competition amongst beat writers. And then before the game, if a guy has been named, probable, questionable, doubtful for that game in shoot around, then we can ask the coach in that game's pregame whether or not, what his status is for that game. And sometimes he'll say it's a game time decision, right? They still have to see him warm up and see how he does in just the minutes right before. But most of the time, that coach will know whether or not he's playing. And that media availability happens. It's an hour and 45 minutes ahead of the tip time of that game. for the home team, and then an hour and a half ahead of the time for the tip time for the away team. So again, that's kind of when we know what's going on with the players, is when we get the chance to ask the coach. So, you know, if it's an hour before something like that and we still haven't reported, then I think that question is fair. Like, hey, you know, if did you happen to hear anything from Quinn Snyder or whoever the opposing coach is, or, you know, whatever, then, you know, we may have some information because we've actually talked to those guys. But if, you know, if it's in the middle of the day, you're between that like noon to 5 p.m. setup, where nothing's going on, and, you know, honestly, we're at lunch or working on our articles or whatever, we're not even going to have an opportunity to ask and try to find out what's going on with those players. So hopefully, like, I know that's awfully specific and awfully insidery, but that's kind of like what our schedule is to try to find this information out.
No, I mean, that's super helpful. I mean, just knowing, I mean, now we know the kind of the exact times, if we're going to, you know, send a tweet to you, when to do it at least.
Yeah. And honestly, that makes a big difference. And that's when we're more likely to have the information that you guys want, and, you know, the rest of our readers want too. So,
right. To follow up with that, how honest, and again, I know this varies team to team. So I guess this can be specific to Quinn Snyder, and then you can kind of give your thoughts on overall NBA. How honest do you think coaches are when addressing, you know, for, let's say, a player is questionable? Do you think, like, at the time, you know, let's say an hour and a half ahead of tip, do you think they kind of pretty much know if a guy's going to go, or when they say, oh, we got to see him warm up, do we think that they really do have to see him warm up before they know?
I think most of the time they really do want to see it, at least with the Jazz is what I've noticed. And the Jazz maybe do that more frequently than other teams, where they'll wait. But it legitimately is kind of these nagging injuries where you want to see how a guy is running around and doing stuff. I mean, like, Derek Favors this season has had these on and off knee injuries that have, I'm sure, frustrated you guys a ton, right?
Yeah.
But it's, you know, he was held out of the Memphis game. What was that? Like, probably 3 weeks ago. Cause when he went and played warmups, he like could barely dunk. Like, he wasn't moving well at all. So, I think there is like some real information that teams get from those warmups. I think sometimes in like playoff kind of games, or playoff contention sort of games at the end of the season, teams do that where they'll wait until the last minute. But, you know, for the most part, I think they really don't know, and that's just them telling us. I'm more frustrated when teams don't give out injury timelines. That's something I've written about this season, where the Jazz will just say he's out indefinitely, and then you have, you know, you have no idea, and that's incredibly frustrating. Maybe not from a daily point of view, but from covering a team point of view, not knowing when a guy is going to return, if it's a week or a 3 months kind of injury, is really frustrating.
And this may be good. This is a question that I've always wondered. So I mean, you're the perfect person to ask this to, because, like, you're the first beat writer we've had on the show. So this is, okay. I mean, there's a lot. I mean, man,
yeah,
I could keep you like 3 hours. You're probably gonna have to shut me up. As my listeners know, I ramble too much anyway. But so, like, at the is there like the shoot around itself? Can you just kind of explain what goes on? Because, like, you know, if you've heard, I've heard the origins, like, that was started just by coaches many years ago, just so players wake up early and aren't partying till 4 or 5 in the morning. Is there like actual, you know, physical, is that just like walking through, like watching film, or just walking through plays for that game? I mean, like, because when you said guys have to test out their injury an hour and a half ahead of the, you know, or whatever, let's say 45 minutes before the game, or whenever they're warming up before the game, like, a coach wouldn't be able to see at the shoot around if that guy would be ready to play at night.
Sometimes they hold them out of shoot around and then only have them warm up before a game. So, okay. You know, that happens, but yeah, so shoot around, it kind of depends on the team, honestly. So, like, the Jazz 3 to 4 years ago, when they were, you know, when they were a young team still developing, Quinn Snyder ran shoot arounds like he did practices. Really, there wasn't really a difference in how he ran those things. You know, he'd have them do a lot of 5-on-5, do a lot of like shell drill, do a lot of kind of like physically taxing kind of things, just because he wanted them to learn the system.
Right.
And now we're in, he's got a kind of veteran group that needs the rest. And now shoot around's much more of a lax affair, where you are just kind of standing around, going through plays, walking through it in 5-on-0 kind of setups. Not, you know, not trying to use too much of your energy that day. So I think that really does depend. From a media perspective, we generally don't see shoot-arounds. I mean, they basically, once a shoot-around is over, they let us in, and we just see the players taking warm-up shots, basically, after that shoot-around ends. And then that's also when we make the request to speak to whichever players or coaches we want to talk to.
Right, cool. Yeah, that's – thanks for that. Because, I mean, yeah, I've always wondered kind of what really goes on with a shoot-around and, you know, how much physical exertion is actually – you know, kind of going on in that hour or whatever, whenever, how long does a shoot around last, by the way? Is it like an hour?
Yeah, like 45 minutes to an hour.
Okay. So it's pretty quick.
Some teams. Yeah. I mean, it's been as short as a half hour before, especially if a team's played another team in a short succession, you know,
right.
You already know the scouting report. You already know the plays you're going to run. You already know the plays they're going to run. They can run a shorter shoot around then, but yeah. So half hour to an hour, I would say.
Okay. Nice. All right, let's hop into a couple different players, or at least one player before we talk about a topic that I love, which is pace,
okay.
For DFS. But and you mentioned this player already. This player, I played him last night in DFS, and I was really intrigued to watching him. And you know, I know injuries are a part of it. You'll be able to shed a lot of light on how much is injury related versus not. Like, so Derek Favors, I'm on the show sheet here. I wrote down the Derek Favors dilemma. And I wrote down dot, 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 or is there one? Because like, I don't know what he is anymore. I mean, like, if you look at his stats this year, so in 43 games, he only played 43, I think, out of like 60 games. He started 35 of those. He gets under 24 minutes a game, only 9 points, only 8 shots a game. So the usage rate is pretty low. 6 boards, not even a block. And his player efficiency rating is a pretty paltry 15.7. I'm just going to say Derek Favors and let you talk. Kind of what can you shed light on to kind of where he currently is and what he's going through this season?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, like I'm thinking if I were a daily fantasy player, I just can't imagine it would ever make sense to play Derek Favors. I mean, unless Rudy Gobert were out. Because basically Rudy Gobert, and I'll get into the injuries in a second, but just from like a role in the offense point of view, Rudy Gobert has supplanted so many of the things that Derek Favors used to do that let him get 20 points and 10 rebounds per game. Just because Rudy Gobert has developed so much as a pick and roll player. He's probably the second or third best roll man in the league right now. So now every single screen is run with Rudy Gobert instead of, you know, last year and especially 2 years ago, every single screen was run with Derek Favors and maybe, you know, a few with Enes Kanter back in the day. But, you know, for the most part, it was the Derek Favors show on offense. And now it's Rudy Gobert to have that roll game and finish the lobs. And, you know, sometimes they'll do double screens with Favors and Gobert, but for the most part, without that roll game, Favors doesn't have natural ways to get touches in the offense. And yep. So what he ends up taking is these kind of outlet passes where he's kind of teams, I guess, hedge away from him. And then he gets these little mid-range jump shots, which he's been hitting at a decent rate this year, but maybe is not the efficient offense you want to see from anybody, right? So, I think he's still like a good rebounder. I think he's still a decent rim protector, and definitely the injuries have played a huge role this season in terms of his availability and really just in terms of what we're seeing from him on the court, especially early. Like, it's clear that he doesn't have the athleticism, the explosiveness that he used to last season. This knee injury really is hampering him and still continues to hamper him. His agency and his camp, I guess, is just kind of hoping to be healthy for next season. But it's not a great situation for Derek. You know, I think he's still a valuable player because he's still good defensively. I think he's a decent outlet, like I say, for those kind of shots. He's a good rim protector. The Jazz are playing him a ton at backup center. Oh, and that's actually another thing. He's played more minutes at backup center this year than he has at the starting power forward position. And I think that's something that's likely to continue because the Jazz have done really well with spacing the floor around Gobert, running lineups like Joe Johnson at the power forward spot. And Quinn Snyder seems really reluctant to play Derek Favors at the end of games. I think last night was a really good example where, you know, the Jazz could have played Favors at the end, but instead went with this spacey kind of lineup with Joe Johnson at the four. So
yeah,
that's been happening over and over again.
Yeah, that, I mean, that's one thing that I kind of noticed. The more, you know, the few times I've watched Utah, you know, the more you think about it and how kind of, I guess, against the grain now using those, you know, having two big guys in almost at any time during the course of a game, but especially late in games where spacing the floor these days has become such a priority for teams. So when you do have a Favors and a Gobert clogging up that paint, you know, a lot of times it doesn't create ideal situations on the offensive end.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's what Quinn Snyder is seeing. And that's why he's not playing much of that lineup at the end of games, even though it is, I think the Jazz's best defensive lineup is their starting unit. It's not their best offensive lineup. And I think that's what he thinks is more of a priority at the end of games. And you know, it hurts Derek Favors' value both in real life and in fantasy.
Like, do we think that Favors then ultimately, one, because Gobert does limit kind of the need to use Favors, like you said, do we think it, so I guess for the rest of this season, you kind of envision his role staying the same around that 24 minute mark and not seeing a ton of upside. Like, do you ever think that he'll be able to get that back at that, you know, with the kind of get over these injuries and he can kind of flash what we saw, you know, a few years ago again, or kind of not sure.
I mean, maybe I honestly think that maybe the most likely situation right now is that he gets moved this offseason and then right. He has a chance to do it with another team, probably from their center spot. I just think that he's a natural center in today's NBA. And it's, you know, we're seeing that it's hard to play him as a four. And I don't know that that's going to be changing next season, even if he is at 100%. So I think the trade this season is maybe, I don't want to say any one player trade is likely, but I could absolutely see the Jazz moving on from him this offseason and finding a kind of a spacey power forward that can play alongside Rudy Gobert in kind of a more natural way.
And until then, do we envision down the stretch these last 20 games or so that Joe Johnson will kind of be finishing the games at the four?
Yeah, I think so. I think he has been before. That lineup is probably the Jazz's best lineup. I think it's plus 20 per 100 possessions going into last night's game, and I think it's played like 300, 400 minutes so far. So it's a decent sample size with a small lineup with Joe Johnson at the four around Gobert. So. I think that's really going to be their look. I think really the biggest question is do they start that look in the playoffs?
Right. Huh. Interesting. Yeah. And to answer your question, why would anyone still play Derek Favors from a fantasy perspective? So a lot of DFS, you know, is based on price, and right. Favors is priced so low across the industry. And so a lot of times we just see the name. We're like, Derek Favors. He used to be so good. So he's so cheap. We got to play him. He's got to do something tonight. And we keep hoping. But now we know, listeners, probably not the best move because he is going to be limited. And the thing that surprised me the most is even when he's in there, just the usage is so down. That's also what surprised me.
Yeah, that's exactly the problem. And I think there are teams where they've started to key off of Favors a little bit, and then he can get the mid-range looks, and then it kind of depends whether or not they're going down. I mean, he has had one 2010 game this season, but, you know, right. There are a lot of players with 2010 games this season. I just can't imagine that makes sense from a, you know, you're right, because the name is great, and he's put up terrific productions in seasons past. I just don't know how he fits in. Too many question marks for me moving forward.
Yeah, I mean, it's like when you're trying to pick plays, you'll see like, Alex Abreen is more expensive than Favors, and you see, you know, all these guys, you're like, what? Like, how is this possible? Or you know, weird things. Or you know, Ersan Ilyasova, even though was just traded to the Hawks, he's still more expensive than Favors, and so you keep hoping. But this was good to get your insight on the, you know, the Favors situation, because the few times I've watched you, Tom, I have a team called like the standing in a corner team. Mm-hmm. And I can almost, you know, players who kind of are on the court, but they go 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 possessions without touching the ball. And Favors has almost become like one of those players. I mean, on certain nights.
Yeah. And I mean, the Jazz's offense moves the ball enough that he ends up touching the ball, but you know, I'm guessing you're not getting fantasy points for touches.
It's, right. That's very true.
It's him doing dribble handoffs and those sort of things. And kind of being out there on the perimeter, cause they want Rudy Gobert down inside. And I like I say, too many question marks for me, and he's, his role in the offense has changed, and don't really know if he's figured out a way that's right now to keep his numbers high, and you know, I think kind of get more involved and keep himself happy, but if he's not doing that, he just doesn't get that many looks. Like I thought he played pretty well last night, and what did he end up with? 8 points.
Yep, 8 points.
That's what you're going to end up with.
Yep. Okay, cool. That was insightful, because a lot of that I did not know. So hopefully listeners found that useful as well, which I'm sure they did. All right, so let's move on to a topic that I love, because one of the things that I love the most from a DFS perspective, and also just, it sometimes it does make games more enjoyable, the teams that are playing fast and pace. And Utah is notorious for playing kind of slow and pace. I think this year they're last in the NBA with about 93.6 possessions per game. Although I should note, they're like 12th in offensive efficiency. I mean, again, you can't just equate, you know, they're playing slow and pace. I mean, they actually are a pretty efficient offensive team. And they're third in defensive efficiency, which makes sense. I mean, defensively with Gobert and even Favors and other guys like that, defensively they're excellent. But just like if you had to kind of pinpoint as to kind of why kind of the pace is so slow for Utah, because I mean, when I watch them, like I don't know, I see the talent and I see like, you know, Gordon Hayward and even George Hill. I mean, George Hill's not super old, he's not super young either. Yeah. Like they do have some athletes there, and Gobert is certainly an athlete. So like the reason they play that slow, is it Quinn Snyder's system? Is it just, is there, I mean, am I missing something? Is there a, what if, you know, from your perspective in terms of the overall pace, what's kind of the rationale? And obviously it's working because Utah's a good team. I mean, they're probably going to finish probably in the fourth spot in the West. So, you know, it does seem to be working, but from your perspective, what's kind of the rationale behind the pace for Utah?
Yeah, I think you hit it a little bit. It's funny, I think, with saying Quinn Snyder's system, and I think that is the biggest thing. It is funny because he came in when he was first hired. He said he wanted to play with pace and space and kind of play like his old Atlanta teams where he was hired from as a Jazz coach. So I think what he realized, and when you play two bigs together, he wanted to create a system that created spacing with movement is what he likes to say. And so in order to do that, you have to run a lot of like dribble handoffs. You have to run a lot of like ahead of time actions. You have to pass the ball around a lot. And I think the Jazz get good shots. I think the offensive rating is a good sign of that. They're ninth in the league in effective field goal percentage. You know, like they're getting good looks. It's just kind of, they have to take their time and run an offense and kind of execute in order to do it. The other funny thing is, you're right that like they do have the athletes to get out in transition, and actually they're the second most efficient transition team in the league when they actually do get out and do that. I think Jazz fans would like to see them push the ball more. I don't know that that's actually going to happen. I do think you have some veterans that do tend to hold on to it. You know, I'm looking at the ones they acquired this season, Joe Johnson and Boris Diaw, who, are going to slow it down and aren't going to be part of a transition-based offense. But, yeah, I think it's just kind of the system where, you know, Quinn Snyder is moving the ball around a lot, setting a lot of screens both high and low and trying to set stuff up and ultimately get a good look in the offense. The other thing with the pace is that the defensive possessions take longer too, right? You know, because the Jazz they don't force any turnovers. What are they? Third to, I guess they're now fifth to last in the league in forcing turnovers.
That stat's a little surprising, isn't it? I would think that they would force more turnovers. No.
That's just kind of not their mentality. It's right now they're just defending the shot at the best level in the league, and instead of trying to win games that way, they're just trying to make guys miss and clear the boards and get up the floor. So walk up the floor. So I think the defense is part of it. You know that the opponents are taking longer possessions. They force a lot of 24-second. Violations, and so you kind of get a slower game on both ends.
Interesting. I mean, do we think if ultimately like Favors got moved in the offseason, that would kind of quicken the pace for next year, maybe
a little bit, but not really. I mean, I should actually look at the numbers and see how the lineup, how that lineup, the spacing lineup, does in terms of pace.
I think like you said, I mean, because the problem with that is if they're taking Favors out and putting in Joe Johnson, that would even slow it up further. Because Joe Johnson, man,
right?
ISO Joe. I mean,
he's walking around pick and rolls, and
exactly.
It's Joe Johnson, who we all know and love. But yeah, exactly. So I don't really see them like, I could see them being like 25th next year if they do that, but it's never going to be, I don't see, unless they, make some really big changes, basically because it's working. I mean, if you look at this roster, I think I would probably be happy with 12th in the NBA in terms of offensive rating. I mean, they have some good talent and some good shooting, but it's not, they don't have like that superstar. They don't have, with the spacing with Derek Favors and Gobert on the floor. I 12th is not bad in my book based on where they are talent wise.
Right. That makes sense. Okay. Let's move on to another guy from Utah who just, since he's been there, when they drafted him, I was pretty psyched. I like this guy. I thought he had some good upside. Maybe he still does. Maybe he still has a nice future in the NBA. We talked about him a little bit at the top of the show, and that's Dante Exum. The thing that's, from an outsider who's watched, not a ton of Utah Jazz, especially with George Hill missing so much time, And maybe he would have got more minutes if Utah wasn't just such a good team and actually battling for home court advantage in the first round. Then Utah could have given him more minutes and felt more comfortable with that. But, even with George Hill playing a little over half the games, 35 out of 60 of the games this year, he's only averaging 18 minutes a game, an 8.7 player efficiency rating, which is, I looked at that and almost fell out of my chair. That's pretty, yeah. That's so low. That's the lowest on Utah, obviously. And just if what does Utah think of him? Do we see him staying with Utah? What's his ceiling going forward? I mean, this year, do you see any way this year he could become a factor for you guys what's your thoughts on kind of Dante right now?
Yeah. I mean, I think he's the backup point guard right now. I mean, and you kind of referenced the time when George Hill was out and he was a starter, but he just played himself off the floor during a lot of those minutes early in the season. I mean, just was making really bad defensive mistakes. And then offensively, I don't know what his skill set is right now. I mean, so the problem is he can't shoot at all, right? He's shooting 27% from three. Yep. And honestly, those are pretty wide open attempts he's taking. He can't shoot from the mid-range at all. And then he can't finish at the rim at all once he gets there. I think he's got a nice first step. He definitely turns it over too much when he does handle the ball, because he's trying to get to the rim and do something there, but ends up kind of having a loose handle. Basically, he's a young guy who clearly didn't play any NBA college, didn't play at like a good high school level, and so is trying to figure this stuff out. And it makes it hard for Quinn Snyder to keep him on the floor, and for you to really like think that he's going to have a great NBA career. You know, he's got all the tools in the world, right? He's 6'6", he's long, I think he's fast and end to end. He's actually was really nice defender his rookie season. I think, like we said at the beginning of the podcast, I think he's lost a step with the ACL tear, and I think he's starting to get it back. But that lateral movement is still kind of, I don't know how much he trusts that movement. It's a weird question, and it sucks because, I think the Jazz put so much time and resources into that fifth pick. They had that terrible season, and that's kind of, Dante was the silver lining, and for him not to turn out what you hoped he would be is a bummer. But I think he's just got a long ways to go to achieve to even be like starting point guard caliber in terms of his offensive game. Defensively, he's starting to fit in with the system a little bit more, and so that's nice. He's earning minutes right now at backup point guard just because Alec Burks too has struggled a lot coming back from injury. So in my mind, a lot of question marks, and his future with the Jazz, he's eligible for an extension this summer. Maybe you take that opportunity and sign it while he's cheap, but I'm guessing that they'll probably wait until he's a restricted free agent at the end of next season and finally see maybe he can use this summer to develop in some way. Cause right now, he's not even a reliable backup point guard.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, quite honestly, when even the games he was starting, I would play Mac.
Cause Mac would get more minutes and would score more and get more assists. Cause I mean, that's exactly right. And Sheldon had a turnover problem and was probably equally bad defensively, maybe worse. So that's why he's not being the backup point guard right now. But I think Quinn Snyder trusted Shelvin Mack more, and heck, maybe his teammates did too.
Do we think some of his confidence as well? Because when I watch him play, and obviously confidence is a tough thing, because then I'm trying to get into the head of a player, which obviously I can't do. Do we think he's lost confidence as well? Because when I watch him play sometimes, it just looks like he doesn't know what to do on the court. And from a guy who's that skilled, or like you said, has all the tools, you would think that wouldn't be the case.
Yeah, no, I think the confidence thing is a real issue. I mean, it's, I think he kind of, and that's how it goes coming back from ACL injuries, is you and especially as a high pick, you come back, you think you're going to have this huge role. You even start for a while, and then your coach takes you out, and you make a few defensive mistakes, and coach pulls you. And I think he does, and you see him a lot looking over to the bench, kind of scared a little bit that it's someone else is coming into the game for him, right? And I think that's a fair criticism, and I think that's you hope he can find that in the off season. But right now, he doesn't really get confidence from his on court play, because he's generally not doing that well. I think he had a couple of games before and after the All-Star break against Portland and against Milwaukee where he did some nice things. But those situations are also perfect for him in terms of having guards who can't defend and then no rim protection whatsoever. Against better defending teams, he's struggled all season long. And I think he just really needs to get to this offseason, work on his game, and then see what he has in year four.
All right, let's talk. So when I asked the listeners for questions, I was shocked at how many questions came back regarding Trey Lyles.
Oh, cool.
Like lots of people love Trey Lyles. And they want to know, can he get more minutes? Thoughts on his outlook, not only rest of the season, but just going forward as well. And occasionally, too, I've been surprised when I have watched Utah, occasionally he jumped like out of nowhere, kind of jump off the screen. I'm like, whoa, like I didn't know Trey Lyles had that kind of game. So just in terms of your thoughts on Trey Lyles, kind of what do you think about him? And how does Utah, the kind of management and the organization feel about him?
Yeah, I mean, for the last couple of games, I think he's a DMP CD. He hasn't played at all because he's played himself out of the rotation a little bit with how bad he's been defensively. I mean, he's pretty bad. It's not that he does the wrong thing so much as he doesn't have any rim protection athleticism. He does kind of overhelp, I guess. He's decent on the perimeter as a perimeter defender. It's just inside he struggles. The surprising thing for me this season is how weird he's been offensively. And it's been in some weird ways. Like, his three-point shooting percentage is down, and he's taken more, so maybe that makes some sense. But he's taking bad shots, and then he's kind of ignoring his teammates. There's a stretch in a blowout game right before the All-Star break where he came into the game and just – clearly just looked for his own shot. I mean, I think he was 0-for-9 in that game in 18 minutes and just, wasn't passing, was trying to take fadeaways from beyond the elbows, like just kind of these no chance shots that I think the shot selection has really kind of played him out of the system, especially when you have like the alternative of Boris Diaw, who's a very good team player. So I think there's still like an opportunity for him to regain some of those minutes in the future. And I'm actually kind of bullish on his NBA career. Cause you're right. Like his skill set's pretty impressive. Like having a big man who can shoot the three, who can move like him, who can be a playmaker really, if he actually wants to be. It's just like right now, I think he's really in his head. Like this is a weird thing to bring up, but on Twitter, he's been like, like the weird NBA cliches of you just got to bring God into it all the time. And just God is going to bring you through the tough times in your life. And maybe there are some tough times in his life that I don't know about, but it just seems like he's lost confidence and he's really kind of overthinking on the court right now. So I don't know if he's going to fix that this season. Again, he's someone who I look at as maybe more of a contributor for next year. He's got all the tools in the world, and I think he really can put them together. Just right now, it doesn't seem like he's there mentally, and it means that he's not playing.
All right, listeners, you heard it there. Trey Lyles, sorry, guys, we can't use him this year. I'm with you in terms of when I watched him this year, I'm like, man, in like the modern NBA, he seems like the ideal fit for the current trend. But obviously, I would guess on a team like Utah, if you can't play defense, that's kind of a big no-no. And obviously being selfish as well, which I didn't know, or looking for his own shot, that's obviously can't go over well either.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, like you say, the skill set's there, and I think maybe he can figure that out. And, I guess I wouldn't say definitely don't play him this year, but until he gets a couple of games in a row where he is playing, he is clearly the lead backup power forward option, I wouldn't bother.
Yeah, and I guess maybe if Favors goes down again or something like that, maybe.
Right. Right.
All right. Next question. Let's wind down only a couple more because I know I've already held you too long probably. Okay. But which quickly regarding Gobert, like how good do you think he is? How good can he get? In terms of getting an offensive game, how much can he grow there? And in terms of like a comparison, you know, I know I've heard a lot of people wanted to say just I think it's lazy just to kind of say DeAndre Jordan. I don't think that's a great comparison myself. I've heard that people just think, oh, rebound and blocks, DeAndre Jordan, you know. But so just your thoughts on Gobert, just kind of because you already kind of mentioned and taught me some stuff I didn't realize like how good he is at the pick and roll, and how much, you know, he's basically the main reason why Favors has become kind of a, you know, somewhat irrelevant for Utah and, you know, this year.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, you mentioned it, like just the pick and roll game, he's gotten to a new level. Previous seasons, he had a lot of problems catching and holding onto the ball and finishing, which, you know, seem like really easy skills until you get into him at the NBA level and have guards poking at him. But he's doing a great job this year of keeping the ball high, holding onto it and finishing well. And, you know, I think you see that in his stats, with 13-13. Don't know like how much more improvement I see, because I don't know if he's going to like get a jump shot or anything. I think he's maybe working on some mid-range stuff, and when I say mid-range, I mean like from 7 to 8 feet away in the paint, things right. Like a hook shot. He's actually working on a floater right now that you'll see right in games and sometimes, and it's really ugly right now, but maybe if he starts to get that together. He's only 24, so you know, I think there is real room for him to actually improve on that side of the floor in just in terms of those couple of things. But I can't imagine he's going to be like a 17 point a game scorer, you know, approach 20 or anything like that. I think this is pretty much who he's going to be, maybe with some nice little counters when teams give him as much space as they do. Yeah. I mean, defensively, he's the best player in the league. Right. So that's great. He's the identity of this team, and it's good that the Jazz have kept him up, you know, locked up long-term.
So I guess that leads into the next question that I have in terms of, you know, and I wrote down here, can Gordon Hayward be the best player on like an NBA title team? And I kind of think the answer to that is no, but let's add Gobert in there. If you have a Hayward Gobert combination kind of, out of those two, I mean, you can make an argument. Maybe Gobert is kind of the best player on Utah. He certainly is defensively. But can those two kind of, I mean, how far can Utah go with those two guys?
I think pretty far. Like in my mind, there are a lot of similarities between this and the championships Pistons team, right? Like you've got solid guards who can do a lot of things on the wings. You've got a solid point guard, whether that be Chauncey Billups or George Hill. I actually think those players are more comparable than people realize, even though, you know, I don't know that their games are that similar in terms of style. I think they're both excellent defensive point guards who could both shoot, you know, shoot extremely well, run a pick and roll well, and be leaders on a team. And then you kind of look at like Rodney Hood's development and whether or not the Jazz can get anything out of Derek Favors or whatever power forward they end up with. And you see a lot of similarities. So, I mean, in order for the Pistons to win that championship, a whole lot of things had to go right. Right. And they had to acquire a legitimately good power forward. Things had to improve, along with their wings. You know, again, like I say, the Jazz need more improvement from their young talent, Rodney Hood, Derek Favors, I guess Dante Exum, Trey Lyles, or maybe get better playmakers at the four. But I think there are some similarities there. I don't know that he's going to be like the best player on a championship team in a traditional sense, you know. And I think he's showing something new over the last month. He's averaged 25 points a game in February, I believe that's right, 25.5 points per game. So, you know, there are some really good things. I don't know that he's like that ball dominant player. I think he plays well when the Jazz play well. And you know, what that does for your team moving forward and your decisions moving forward in terms of acquiring players, I don't know. But I think the Jazz's best chance is with this and hope some other teams get injured. You know, if Kevin Durant were out for the playoffs, all of a sudden you think maybe the Jazz have a shot to make it out of the West, maybe.
Maybe
that might be optimistic.
No. I mean I could see that. So I kind of lost my train of thought when I was Oh, I know what I want to ask. This has bugged me for a couple of years. Like, I think Gordon Hayward's a great playmaker. Mm-hmm. Is there a reason he doesn't initiate more offense? Because I never really, even when George Hill was on Indiana, even San Antonio going way back there, he never was like a true kind of point guard. Defensively, he was great. I like his skill set. But like, and even last year as well, I always wondered why isn't Gordon Hayward kind of doing more initiating the offense, and why aren't his assist numbers up a little bit? Is there, even this year, I think he was like around 3.5 assists. I think that he could get around 6, somewhere like that. Is there, am I missing something there? Is there a reason why he doesn't kind of get more opportunities to be a playmaker?
No, I mean, I think basically it goes back to Quinn Snyder's system being so egalitarian and so ball movement and kind of honestly so slow, is you end up getting all these plays where everybody's touching the ball, and then it's kind of a read and react system. And so I think that is starting to change a little bit with the ball in Gordon Hayward's hands more over the last month or two, like I said. But ultimately, I think with Snyder's system is set up so that like whoever is open and takes the shot, right? And I think most defense is key on Gordon Hayward being the Jazz's best offensive player and try to prevent him from taking those shots. And like I said, he's doing more this year. We've seen these dunks over the last week that have kind of blown up SportsCenter and Twitter and everything else. I think he's taking it to the rack more. I think he's becoming more aggressive with his shot. I just don't know that he's going to be getting that many more playmaking opportunities than he already is. Again, that's how his system is set up. Snyder's system is set up to kind of share the ball and just get the ball in the hands of whoever's open.
Right. Okay. And last question for you.
I think that's a good question.
Because I mean, especially last year when they did not have George Hill, I wondered that even more, but this year as well, I have wondered, cause he seems like he could be an elite playmaker, but just hasn't seemed to work out exactly. All right. But last question, we'll get to you. Just rest of the season outlook for the Jazz. And in terms of if there's one player on Utah and maybe, kind of an under the radar player, maybe it's Rodney Hood. That's another guy. I mean, I could have spent an hour talking to you about Rodney Hood, another guy who's kind of been a player who's been on our radar from a DFS perspective all year, a lot of injuries. Occasionally he'll have a great game. Then he had some weird, I don't know if it was a flu or what, for a couple of weeks. I watched him play. It looked like he was a dead man walking on the court. It was very bizarre. So just a perplexing guy. But if you had to give just, kind of a real life NBA perspective, where do you think Utah is going to finish this year, their chances in the playoffs? And then, if you had to pick one or two guys to look out for who could really have a nice kind of finish these last 20 games or so, who do you think those two would be? Go ahead.
So just from an overall season point of view, they've got the hardest schedule left in the Western Conference playoff race. And so that's going to be a battle, but finally they're healthy, right? Which they haven't really been all season long. So it's kind of a battle of those two forces playing out. And that kind of depends whether or not they really are battling for home court in the first round of the playoffs. And I think that four seed is probably the most likely end up spot right now, maybe the five seed, but that's kind of the story moving forward, is just how this team fits together. And I think maybe larger questions like where Derek Favors versus Joe Johnson at the power forward spot questions, how this team works with kind of a defense first lineup versus an offense first lineup and having those two different roles. And I think Gordon Hayward, can he keep up the last month or so of performances is a big question, but really it's just kind of how this team does during a playoff race and can they keep that four seed is a major storyline. And, they've got plenty of chances to see how they do against the West best with, like I say, a difficult schedule moving forward. Some kind of guys to watch out for, I guess. I think George Hill will continue to be up and down just based on his toe injury still is bothering him. Looking at him in the locker room, he's got like a gumball sized bump on his foot, and it's really kind of like on the toe, the ball of his foot rather than his toe. So that's really impacting how he's moving around, and he's it's why he hasn't had the performances that he had in the first month of the season.
But he started off the year. I was shocked with how fast he started off the year.
Right. And he was, you could have made a case he was Jazz's best player in November before this toe injury happened. And it's not getting any better as he keeps playing on it throughout the year. So I guess I would say he's not going to probably fill that role for the Jazz at the end of the season or in the playoffs. I think Rodney Hood, you know, you mentioned him, and I think you're absolutely right. This is the guy who, to me, has the capability of breaking out to be better than he has been this season. I mean, he's just so skilled. He's so good from the mid-range. He is gets so much height on his jumper, and it's such a good shot. I think as he's healthy and plays his way more into the rotation, not the rotation, but obviously from a starting lineup point of view, and there are times where he just takes over games, and I think we're going to see the Jazz need more of that as the game kind of slows down even more at the end of the season and in the playoffs. I think Rodney Hood's really good, kind of maybe not a breakout candidate, but he's going to be a big part of this Jazz team. And I would say probably up his average in terms of scoring, assists, rebounding, all those sort of things as the Jazz give him more minutes.
So is he finally healthy now? Is he close to 100% as he's been kind of all year?
Yeah, I mean, so he just came back from, what was it, the sprained LCL that he rested over the break. He said he wasn't quite 100% when he first came back in Milwaukee, but it sounds like he's back at 100%. He looked like he was back at 100% last night against the Thunder. And it's not kind of a nagging injury. I think he's really going to be good, and he's getting more touches in the offense as he gets more healthy. So I am significantly less worried about his injury than I am either of George Hill or Derek Favors moving forward.
Interesting.
And then Joe Johnson, like I said, I think he's going to be playing a bigger role, playing more power forward, playing both the primary backup power forward and more small forward minutes, maybe even starting at the end of the season or in the playoffs. I think just the data shows that that's the Jazz's best lineup, and it's working for them. We saw it get to that 18-2 run that gave the Jazz a chance to win last night against the Thunder. You know, I think the Jazz will continue to go to that more and more as these games matter more and more.
Nice. Beautiful. Honestly, cannot thank you enough for coming on the show. I know your time is valuable and you're a busy guy. And this, like, for me, and I know for my listeners too, this is going to be super helpful. I mean, like, you know, hearing about things like shoot around, things like that was cool. And then not to mention just getting insight on the Jazz that honestly, me and listeners can't get anywhere else. So this was awesome, I think. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks for having me. No problem. And, you know, I'd say to you and your listeners, if you guys do have questions, and I maybe overplayed how annoyed I would be if you guys...
Oh, don't lie. Oh, yeah. Don't lie. Now I can't wait to tweet at you. I want you to be nasty. If I ever tweet you anything, just come back and be like, you know, leave me alone.
I'm not that guy. Follow me at Andy B. Larson or tweet me at Andy B. Larson if you guys have any questions.
Cool. All right. Cannot thank you enough, Andy. Thanks again for coming on the show. The listeners out there, there you go. Now we are all experts on the Utah Jazz. So now we know what to do going forward the rest of the year. Hopefully we can make some nice money off of Utah. And now I think it'll be more enjoyable just for us watching the Utah Jazz play in general to kind of have an idea on why certain things are happening on the court. So again, thanks to Andy. And that's going to be it for us, for me and Andy, by the way. So I run a show, and I have the bailiff. My dog is the bailiff on the show.
Okay.
So I'm not, now is when I say, for me and the bailiff, that's my dog. Court, you can laugh. It's fine. Totally fine. I do weird things on this show, man. Court is a groomer. Thanks again to Andy. And I'll see you guys back here probably for a podcast tomorrow discussing, I guess it would be, what, Thursday slate? All right. So later, guys.